This is week five of the mindfulness flow of mind and heart. Today's topic is called Seeing It Through. We're going to try to put it all together. Before we start, just a couple of things. It's a busy week. It's a busy week this week at Binovit. First of all, today's learning is going to be in memory of Chaim ben Mordechai HaKohen. His name is Charles Katz, the grandmother of Colleen Shane, whose yard site is today. And we're going to be learning in his memory. I just have a couple of announcements that I wanted to sort of go through before we start. Obviously, besides the big event on Tuesday evening, where I hope to see most of you there. Mirtz Hashem, thanks to all those that are booked already. Just a couple of other things. Number one, next week, 24th of August, Rabbi Leibel Wolf, who's the guest speaker on Tuesday night, will be giving the lesson. Next Thursday morning, his topic will be emotional freedom, taming anxiety to create inner calm. After that, we're going to be having a new series just for 2 weeks, which I'll be giving, which are leading up sort of towards the coming up to Yontif. Yeah, this is that time of the year, believe it or not. Which we're going to be calling Change. What is it? Is it possible? And how do you do it? And thirdly, just in a couple of weeks, you know, we've started this mindful minyan, but we're going to do a special one in a few weeks, the 8th of September, which will be together with a mindful meal, Shabbat meal, which will require booking. The details will be on the email, so stay tuned and come along if you can. I wanted just to start today with a bit of review, because I want to put it all together, so just summarize, so to speak, what we've done till now. We talked about the mind at the beginning. We spoke about the Chochmah and the Binah, the power of the different stages of thinking, the power of thinking something through properly, the significance of the pause when we have stimulus and response, that pause in the middle just to stop and think, review, be open to new ideas, sometimes dig into the subconscious for fresh ideas, build the argument, which is the concept of Binah, connect to it, which is the Da'at, and so on and so forth. That's what we did the first couple of weeks, which of course requires a focus, and tying it into the mindfulness idea, to do this requires a very significant level of ability to take control of our mind and to be focused, so that we actually have that ability to think and to pause and to focus on understanding and processing ideas. The last 2 weeks we discussed emotions, so things become much more difficult to manage. Because as we said, the mind is where existence enters into our reality, whereas emotions, the heart, is where we connect to the outside, which is much more difficult, because the emotions is where the I, the me, the ego gets mixed in, because it's our response, it's our emotional involvement, and that's where it becomes much more difficult to manage, and that's where the mindful approach becomes that much more important and significant. Where we talked about a couple of ideas, first of all, the becoming aware of our own emotions, and also the freshness of the moment, understanding that, not to develop that ability, which is very, very difficult. We're going to come back to it a little bit at the end of today, the ability of not carrying the emotional baggage, either from the past or even the worrying of the future, into the present moment, but to, as we explained last week at length, we certainly learn from the past and prepare for the future, because it's one long mission, and we do have an overall mission that all the dots and all the moments are connected, yet it's more of a non-emotional carry-through, and that emotionally we try to connect to the moment with confidence, with conviction, with belief in our decision that we've made based on our values, to do it in a proper way, but to get the full potential out of the present moment. Then we went on to explain the concept of chesed and gvura, which are the building blocks of emotion. We explained that chesed is the foundation of everything, which is the concept of connection. Our emotions, healthy emotions, are there to create connections with others, with the rest of the world, which is why sometimes we even need gvura, but it's still founded on the concept of chesed, which is holding back in order to give. Incidentally, the chesed and gvura, by the way, concept is really the building blocks or the ingredients of every relationship. Marriage, parents, whatever it is, we have the concept of chesed and gvura, even in the very simple but critical fundamental formula of love and respect. So love is about giving and connecting, but the problem is that love can become suffocating if we don't respect the other person, which means we give the person space, we give the person their individuality, we don't overwhelm them, we respect and nurture them as an individual person. So respect often is about holding back, whereas love is giving. So that love and respect, which we've talked about in the past, is also the chesed and gevurah concept. And then last week we spoke at length about the concept of tiferet, which has many translations. We said beauty, harmony, compassion, truth. And we work backwards explaining that's exactly what tiferet is. At the end of the day, chesed or gevurah is us. It's our response. Whereas tiferet is that looking for what the truth of the moment requires. What does the experience need? What is going to be beneficial for the connection? What is going to be beneficial for the relationship? And often the outcome is a synthesis or a harmony or a combination or a balance between chesed and gevurah. And that's why it's such an important and critical tool. It's that middle path, the concept of being able to apply that concept of tiferet. But once again, over here, to be able to construct this and to really do this needs an amazing amount of consciousness and awareness and paying attention to ourselves and our feelings and being mindful of what we are feeling. It's easier to be mindful about something that's coming from the outside, a concept, but to be mindful of what we are feeling without clouding it because of the ego that's getting in the way is very difficult. To be aware of what I am feeling, to be aware of where it's coming from, is it coming from my ego, is it objective, is it true? And to be aware of, I might be feeling, and this is where it's coming from, but I know that what's needed is a modification, what's needed is something different. And that's a very, very difficult process, and it's something we need to take a lot of getting used to doing. Now, to put it all together today, what I want to do is, therefore, we've done it in using the triangles of human experience, the cognition and the emotions. Let's go to the next triangle, which is the next three emotions called Netzach, Hod, and Yesod. This particular diagram, by the way, translates Hod as splendor. I'm not going to translate it that way because it does have that translation, but it's not really accurate in terms of this particular context. But let's talk about the Netzach on the right first. So first of all, this triangle is what I call the supportive triangle. In other words, the core emotions of the human being is driven by the Chesed, Gevurah, Tiferet triangle, right? Essentially, every way we respond to the outside world is driven by either chesed or gevurah or tiferet, combination of both. What supports that triangle and make sure that it's implemented or it's maintained and sustained and strong is the next triangle of Netzach, Hod, and Yesod. They're supportive emotions. What is Netzach? So, Kabbalistically, Netzach also has a number of translations. Why? But before we go through them, the Kabbalists explain that Netzach, although it's one of the 10 powers of the soul, but actually it's the one power of the soul that is deeply rooted in the very essence of who we are. And it comes in a way from a deeper place than all the other 10. Why? Because we can think properly, we can develop feelings of chesed, gevurah, and tiferet, even if it's in a good and positive, effective context. And yet sometimes we just don't have the strength to follow it through. We get tired. Because even when we're filled with kindness, for example, we want to help other people. We want to work through a relationship. We want to do something that's beneficial for the connection between us and our children. We want to do something that will build and nurture the relationships we have with our friends or family, whatever the case is, or the world around us. It's often challenging and often needs a lot of work. And often there are all sorts of things that interfere along the way that make it difficult. And even before we've tried, we often give up. We might be very passionate about something and yet I don't have the koyach, as I say. I don't have the strength just to follow it through. I've had too many setbacks. I've tried too many times and it hasn't worked. I've tried too many times and the response I got was negative. And so on and so forth. I've tried to control my anger. I've tried to control my eating. I've tried to control the way I speak to people. I've tried to control my judgmentalism. All these kind of things. And you give up. And, which is normal.
Might as well opt out of the world.
Well, we give up on different levels, I should say, right? No, and people say things like, you know, that's just me, you know, put up with me the way I am and that's it, right? But we have one of these supportive emotions is this thing called netzach, which is a deep, deep down ability to be determined, to be resilient, to fight, and to win. In fact, the word netzach actually means victory. Right? And that victory is not necessarily a victory over other people, although when it's distorted, it becomes that way, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But it's more a victory over ourselves, and over our own stumbling blocks, and over our own obstacles. Right? And it's that ambition, healthy ambition, to win that inner struggle that makes us determined, that gives us that feeling of resilience and ultimately gives us that victory over our own personal growth struggle. And that's and the reason why I say that it's deeply rooted within our soul, because the Kabbalists explain that one of the most deepest, in a good and bad way, one of the most deepest emotions that are the strongest and most powerful character traits of a human being is the willingness to win. Now, the best way, unfortunately, to understand this is in the negative. Right? You know, sometimes people will do the most stupidest things to be right, to win an argument. They will not give up. There's a concept they talk about, it's not so relevant today because we don't have that king sort of structure, but there's a idea brought in Kabbalah where they talk about a melech, a king, who's got treasures of resources, of funds, of expensive things stored away that he's inherited from his parents and grandparents and will never use them, only in an emergency, and that emergency will be when he's attacked and when there's a war and when there's suddenly his kingdom, his very essence, his very identity, so to speak, is being challenged. Suddenly there will be what they call in Kabbalah bizbuz ha'otzrot, which means there'll be a complete opening up of the accounts, unlimited bank account, just use whatever you want, just win. You've got to win. Give up everything. Normally stuff that I'm saving, I'll be beyond, you know, look. That's the concept of winning. That's normally in a negative sense. But we are taught that we, each and every one of us, have this. We just have to access it. We access that spark within ourselves that wants to do the right thing, that wants to overcome the inner struggle, that wants to grow as a human being, that wants to overcome those things that stand in the way of our personal growth, our spiritual growth, our emotional growth, whatever the case might be. Once we can access it, then we can be determined, we can be resilient, and we can overcome those obstacles, and we can ensure that the feelings of the good feelings of chesed and gvura and tiferet that we have within ourselves, that we build within ourselves, we determine to carry them through. We determine to use them even when something stands in the way, we're going to overcome it. Like Avraham Avinu, the famous story, when Avraham Avinu was tested by God, Abraham was tested by God to take his only son to the altar, right? It was the ultimate test. And by the way, it was the ultimate test that was called the ultimate test because it was against his nature, right? As we've talked about before, the whole concept of growth, you have to have chesed and gevurah. It's a fascinating concept that when Avraham Avinu was told to take his son to the Akedah, it was the ultimate test that God gave him. By the way, it's a test that we get a lot of mileage out of. We keep on mentioning it in our prayer, especially Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. We keep on asking God, remember what Avraham Avinu did, right? He was ready to take his own son to the Akedah for you, so, you know, remember us. We still, thousands of years later, we still seem to be able to use it, right? But the most fascinating verse in the Torah is that God said to him afterwards, obviously he told him afterwards not to do it and take his son down and so on. And he said to him, take your son down because you've passed the test. And there's an amazing verse. The verse says, Ataya Daiti, says God. I now know, we've talked about this before, I now know that you're a God-fearing person. And the commentaries say, that's a bit unfair. Avraham Avinu was tested 10 times. He was told to go to Israel. Then he came to Israel. There was a famine. He had to leave Israel. He was challenged. He was challenged by friends of his. He was challenged by God to circumcise himself. All kinds of things. And he passed all the tests with flying colors. 9 out of 10. 9 out of 10 is not a bad mark. So what do you mean, now I know that you're a God-fearing Jew? And if I would have failed this test, if Avraham Avinu would have failed this test, he wouldn't have been a God-fearing Jew. Halavai, we should be able to get 9 out of 10, you know what I'm saying? Like, for the things that we're supposed to do. But the commentaries say, no, the concept was this. The first nine tests that Avraham Avinu got were in sync with his nature, with his personality. As you know, the difference between Abraham and Isaac is Avraham and Yitzchak is that Avraham represented, personified the concept of Chesed. Yitzchak personified the concept of Gevura. The first nine tests were in sync with Chesed, or at least didn't contradict Chesed. And therefore, yes, they were hard, they were difficult. Avraham Avinu went for it, passed the test. Then God comes and says, okay, now I'm going to see if you're a truly God-fearing Jew. I'm going to give you a test that is the ultimate of Gevura. Nothing more Gevura than taking your own son and putting him on the altar. And see if you're ready to do it. And he was. Even though that was the most, wasn't just the tenth test, wasn't just the most sacrifice, the most difficult because of his own son, it was the most difficult because it wasn't his personality. Right? That's why God says, now I know that you're God-fearing Jew, because now I know it's not just this test. I now know that the other nine were also coming from a good place. They weren't just coming because that's your personality. They were coming because you really wanted to grow. So the Medrash tells us that on the way to the Akedah, it was a three-day journey from Be'er Sheva to the Temple Mount. It's a three-day journey, walking. On the way, the Satan, which is an angel created by God in Jewish thought to test us and to tempt us and to make things difficult, got permission from God to prevent Avraham, to test Avraham not to do it, to make it difficult, even though it was already a difficult test. But he wanted to, he said, okay, you think it, let me make it really difficult for him and see if he'll pass the test. And God said, okay. So Satan comes down and says the Medrash, fascinating Medrash, and creates a river, an imaginary river, all of a sudden in Avraham Avinu's way. So he's traveling, he's unaware that the route has a river, he didn't know. Didn't see it on Google Maps, wasn't there. So he comes and there's nowhere to go, can't travel. So perfect excuse. Could have turned around and said, God, I tried. Sorry. Right. I tried, but you know, next time give me a proper route, don't tell me. Because he said, you know, you travel, I'll show you the mountain that you have to go to. You know, if you gave me something that I could... So he doesn't. He goes into the river. And the Medrash says he goes into the river and he keeps going, just keeps walking until the water comes to here. And then he turns to God and he says, God, I want to do what you want me to do. I want to pass this test. And the river disappears. Right? So, of course, it's not about that story. It's about everything in our life. Because we all have akedahs that we need to do. Not in the literal sense. We all have sacrifices that we need to make. We all have things that we have to do that are difficult for us. And that's fine. That's part of growth. They're difficult because they don't fit into our personality. Whichever one it is, chesed or gevura. But we all have things that are part of our value system that we know we need to do in order to grow, which are difficult. And the problem is that once we make that resolve to do it, often, you know, people will say to me, I know I had to do it and I tried it. Like, why is it so difficult? Why does God make it so difficult? And part of the reason is it's sometimes that difficult because that's the real growth. The real growth is to overcome that. And like Avraham Avinu in the river, who jumps into the river because he had that netzach, he says, no, this is something I need to do. That was his value system, and it's difficult for me. It's not going to be good for business. Don't forget, Avraham Avinu was, at the time, he was spreading monotheism. He was the only one in the world. Can you imagine what would have happened is if everyone got to know that he sacrificed his own son? He'd close up shop, he'd go bankrupt. He closed down his center, right? So he knew this, he knew all of that, as the commentaries explain at great length, and yet he says, no, that's my mission, obviously, because God wants me to do that, so therefore I'm going to keep going. It's that determination. He jumps into the river, and as the commentaries tell us, the way it works is that we have to jump into that river until we know we've done absolutely everything that we can, and then we also have to turn to God and say, that's it, I can't do more, now you help me. And if we have gone up to our head in the water, then God removes the river a lot of times. So that's the netzach, that's the ambition that we have to access. In modern literature, in modern language, they call this grit. Right? It's an abbreviation, which I forgot what it is. But And it's written about a lot. It's that passion. It's that stamina. And you know, there's an author which I think we've talked about before. Angela Duckworth, her name is, who wrote extensively on this concept of grit. And what she did was she did a lot of research. Interesting thing, on success of students and of school students and college students and success generally in life. And she ran a proper, extensive scientific study on what makes people succeed. And at the end of the day, the most fascinating part about the whole thing was that talent was not the number one, but grit was, right? The willingness to persevere, the willingness to keep going, the willingness to be determined, to overcome obstacles. That's in general concept of the life. That's in general ideas of how we experience our day-to-day life activities. But it's certainly true inwardly in terms of how we grow internally, how we grow with our emotions, how we grow with our responses, that the chesed and gvura, which are the primary drivers of who we are, we need to have that netzach, we need to have that ability to say, if it's the right thing to do, I'm going to jump into the river, I'm going to keep going, I'm going to be determined, I'm going to stay the course, I'm going to not give up. Sometimes that's extremely difficult, but that's the concept of netzach, and that's the concept of the ambition to climb the ladder of personal growth and to do the right thing and to win, even when there's setbacks. However, netzach alone can be a problem. Why can it be a problem? Because by its very definition, netzach is a very I emotion. And this is the problem of human function, as we've said many times. Many things which are strong and effective are also part of me. And as soon as the me gets mixed in, it's a big problem. That's where ego takes over. Which is why we also know that ambition can be incredibly negative. Incredibly negative. There are very, very big ambitious people in the world who are arrogant, who are destructive, who don't mind to destroy anyone else in their path, that will set their eyes on a certain goal and achieve it, no matter what the damage to other people or other things might be in the process, as long as they have achieved what they wanted to achieve. You see that? Right? So how do you balance? Sorry? Well, okay, I'll leave it to everyone else's assessments, but it's a problem. Ambition can become very arrogant by definition. It's not just ambition mixed with ego. Ambition can become ego because it's very much I'm so determined. I'm so strong. Nothing will stand in my way. I'll never give up. You see how that can just very quickly become a very I thing. So let me share with you something which I know I have shared with you previously, but it's so important for this understanding, this concept. It's a beautiful idea. So, let's just work this through. If ambition becomes arrogant, if ambition becomes egocentric, it undermines the very purpose of emotions, as we spoke about last week. At the end of the day, chesed has to be the foundation of all our emotions. In other words, emotions, we were given emotions in order to connect with the world outside of us. That's what emotions is. It's about connecting to the outside world. It's about response to other people and other things. Healthy emotions, as we said last week, equals healthy connections. Egocentric emotions undermine the very aspect, the very purpose of our emotions. Therefore, when netzach is there, we have this netzach, this determination, and we wanna be able to use that as a means of grit, to stamina, determination. But if it derails into an egocentric emotion, it undermines the very purpose of the emotion. Okay. Sorry, I'm a bit behind you. Okay. So in that triangle. You'll notice that Netzach is on the right, and then we have Hod on the left. Okay? Netzach and Hod, and then the middle is Yesod. So Netzach is on the right, Hod is on the left. Netzach is on the right because it's a right type of emotion. It belongs to the family of Chesed. It's about connecting and giving and going towards and moving along and overcoming and just keep on going. The antidote to that, the balance to that, the ingredient which is critical to keep the Netzach in check is Hod, which means humility. ambition has to come together with humility. Because humility keeps the Netzach in check, so that people, the person who has the quality of Netzach and is determined and resilient and moves forward and overcomes obstacles, will always remember why the Netzach is there. Why are we ambitious in the first place? That the goal is the connection to others. The goal is to accommodate others. The goal is to nurture and strengthen the connection I have to other people, the relationships I have, the kindness that I'm able to give. To be able to sometimes be able to hold back my ambition. Not because I'm giving up, but for the very purpose of making space for other people and other things and other ideas. And sometimes to hold back the things I want to achieve because I need to give other people space or accommodate other viewpoints or other concepts. It's a big balance. So let me share with you an amazing idea which I once saw in one, and I don't remember where I saw it. I think it was the Ma'ariv of Hashemesh, one of the Hasidic masters, but one of those commentaries on the Chumash, where he shares an unbelievable idea based on a story in the Torah. It's the story of Korach, the rebellion of Korach. It's a big story, a very, very complicated story, but essentially the story goes like this, where Korach and his group of people come and they wage a rebellion against Moses. Right? And it's a very complicated story, exactly what the agenda was, exactly what the goal was, but essentially it boils down to this, that they rebelled against Moshe and Aaron, and they said, why is it necessary to have people who are elite, so to speak, who are leaders? Why are certain duties reserved only for certain people? We want to be the same. We want to also do it. So one of their big things was this, that they looked at Aaron, Moses' brother, as the Kohen Gadol. He was the high priest. And he was the only one, as was throughout the temple, who had the permission to offer up incense. Right? Incense was one of the big rituals in the temple, which was done every day in a certain part of the temple. On Yom Kippur, it was done in the Holy of Holies. Not for now to go into the significance of the incense. It's the idea of smell, idea of the soul connection with God, etc., etc., etc. But it was a very, very important ritual. And the Kohen Gadol was the only one who represented the whole Jewish people. His role was to do this. And his thing was to take a pan. How he would do it, he would take a pan. And he would go in to the Holy of Holies with coals on the pan. And then put the incense on top of the coals. That would generate a cloud of smoke. That smoke represented the divine presence. And so on and so forth. So Korach and his men says, why is he the only one that can do that, as an example? Why can't we all be high priests? Why can't we all be at the same level? Why can't we all do the same mission and role and so on? So here's the theory of the pans and the sand. So Moses tells them two things. He says, you're making a very big mistake. Because I understand why you want to be a Kohen Gadol. In fact, Moses says a very interesting line. He says, Afani rotze. He says, I would also like to be a Kohen Gadol. But I can't. Because God said there's only one Kohen Gadol for whatever reason. Fine. But you're testing me, says Moshe Rabbeinu. I'll tell you what to do. All of the 250 of you, take pans. I'm not sure if they look exactly like this, but take pans. Tomorrow morning come, wait a night, cool off. He was hoping maybe they'd repent through the night, which they didn't. Take the pans, put coals, place incense on the coals, go into the temple, bring incense. You know what? I'm telling you now, there's not going to be only the person who God has chosen will survive, but you can all go for it. And if you survive, you survive. That's fantastic. Of course, the story ends tragically. They did not heed the warning. They went into the holy, they took pans, they put coals, they put incense, they went into the Holy of Holies, and they all died. There was two punishments that happened there, the Chumash tells us. Korach and his families were swallowed up by a sudden earthquake. The ground opened up. The rest of them, a fire came out from heaven and consumed them. And it was a big tragedy, and they all passed away. And then we find a very strange thing that happens in the Chumash. In the Mishkan, in the tabernacle in the desert, I'm going to give you these details so you understand the concept. There was a Mizbeach, an altar. It was called Mizbeach Adama. It was an altar made out of stone, out of sand. God says to Moshe Rabbeinu, you should take all the 250 pans that were used for this rebellion, melt them down, and create a cover, a metal cover, for the altar. That's what you should do with them. If you want to know what to do with these 250 pans, that's what you should do with them. Melt them down and create a metal, a copper cover for the Mizbeach, for the altar. So the commentaries ask a question, isn't this bizarre? The 250 pans were pans of people who had staged a rebellion against God's choice. They were not good people. They were responsible for creating machloket. They were responsible for creating disunity and division among the Jewish people. They created a whole rebellion. There was pandemonium. It was a terrible moment. In fact, the Torah later on says, one of the mitzvot in the Torah, when the Torah warns us not to create disunity, not to create conflict, negative and unnecessary conflict, the Torah says, do not be like Korach and his men. Right? What would symbolize, what would be the tangible physical piece of evidence that would symbolize the terrible tragic story of disunity and disharmony that Korach and his men led? It would definitely be these pans. That was what was left off of these people. So we should take these pans and create a cover for one of the holiest objects in the temple, the object upon which daily sacrifices were brought, and the sacrifices were considered like the symbol of connection between the Jewish people and God. When the fire went up, and then this was the symbol of the divine presence. And in times of temple, for whatever, this is not the time to go into the whole concept of sacrifices, but the bottom line is, in the times of temple, the whole relationship between us and God was through the daily rituals and the daily sacrifices of the temple. And so what are we going to do? Every time someone comes to bring a sacrifice, what is he going to see, or she see? She's going to see the pans, the cover made out of the pans of Korach. I mean, maybe it'll be a good warning, but not there. I mean, like, you know, imagine like this, it's like saying we should take something really bad and make a curtain for the Aron Kodesh. I mean, this doesn't make sense. Right? So he says an amazing insight. Listen to this. Some of you might remember when I've done a long time ago, but this is the insight. It says like this. He says the pans intrinsically were not bad. Why? Remember what Moshe Rabbeinu told these people? Moshe Rabbeinu said, you know, I also want to be a Kohen Gadol. How could Moshe Rabbeinu say that? Bottom line is, what Korach and his men did was wrong. They were challenging Aaron. It was a wrong thing. So what's Moses trying to placate them and say, you know, I'm actually with you. I also would like to be a Kohen Gadol. No, he wasn't saying that. What Moses was telling them was this. I understand you. Where you're coming from, you're actually beginning at a good place. You have ambition for spiritual connection. You have Netzach. You want to grow. You want to do things. They weren't bad people. They weren't just stum, as they say, making a breugers or making a conflict. Some of these people were actually great people. They were looking for spiritual experience. They were looking for spiritual meaning. They were looking for spiritual connection. They were really ambitious. The pans were a symbol of ambition. However, it was misguided ambition. Says Moshe Rabbeinu, your ambition is good. Afani, I also have that ambition. Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, was of course the most ambitiously spiritual person. I also have that ambition. But I understand that sometimes ambition doesn't mean I can do whatever I want. There are breaks, there are boundaries on ambition. And what I'm telling you, Moshe Rabbeinu is telling him, he says, I see you have ambition. You have Netzach, but you have it without the Hod. You have it without the humility. It's not balanced. And very soon what's going to happen is your ambition starts at a good place, but you're so focused on your ambition that with all the warnings I'm going to give you, your ego is going to get in the way. Exactly what happened. If they had guided ambition, if they were humble, if they had hod together with the ambition, they would have listened to Moses. They would have said, okay, I understand, you're right, we hold back. This time, we're ambitious, the ambition is good, we have to rechannel it into something different. Bringing incense in the temple is not the way to do it. We understand. But they didn't do that. Why? Because they had ambition, they had Netzach, but without any hod, without any humility. Says God, I want this to be a lesson for all people. I want you to take these pans, which I don't despise, because essentially these pans are good. They're a symbol of their spiritual ambition. But I want you to make with them a cover of the altar. Why? Because the altar was made out of earth. Earth is a symbol of humility. Humility. Always in Kabbalistic works, you always see the earth is a symbol of humility. Because it's the lowest thing and you walk on it and so on and so forth. Right? Earth is a symbol of humility. Says God, if you take these pans and they don't exist in isolation, but they exist as a cover for the earth, and it's Netzach together with Hod, it's ambition to balance and harmonize together with humility, that's a holy altar. That's a beautiful sight. That's a pure image. And that's the lesson, that when everyone came every single day to the temple and saw this altar, they saw these pans, but they saw the pans not alone. They saw these pans melted down, covering the earth. In other words, the ambition, but supported and driven by humility. That was a great combination. And with that combination, you end up with a third one, Yesod. And Yesod, the Kabbalists tell us, is the concept of connection. Then we really be able to connect to other people. When we have Chesed, Gvura, and Tiferet within our emotional feelings, and we're able to carry it through and support it with a feeling of tremendous ambition and sustainability, but supported and guided by humility, then we can really connect and be ready to use our six emotions and our structure of our healthy emotions to connect to other people and create healthy relationships. And then, after all of that, we've got to put it into practice. That's all within us. But then we've got to implement it, right? Because sometimes we've got it all right and we're almost about to do it, and then we forget to implement it. And that's the last one of the 10, the one all the way at the bottom called Malchut. I just thought we'd finish it off this week because I want to leave you with a half a picture. Right? So we talked about the triangle of intellect, triangle of emotion, triangle of supportive emotion, and then all of that is Malchut. And Malchut has many, many, many translations. The word Malchut means kingship, leadership, right? But also very often is used as a symbol of implementation, and also sometimes Malchut is used for a word for communication. Why? Because what is Malchut? It's one of the seven emotions, so to speak. But what is it? It's always put separately to the other six. So it's like a king, right? It's like leadership. What is leadership? Leadership is not a talent on its own. Leadership only means a true leader can use what everyone else has to connect to other people and to lead other people. In other words, it's a processing mechanism, right? There are academics which are much smarter than good leaders, and yet they can't lead because they don't have the ability to process it and to make it work on the outside. A leader means they can take their own intellect, they can take their own emotions, they can take their own feelings, they can process them properly and push it outside, that it actually connects with the world outside of us. That's why it's also used as a symbol for communication. Because that's exactly what words are. We've talked about this before. What are words? Nothing. You can talk nonsense also if you want. Right? You can make up any nonsense word if you want, and it'll mean nothing. So words, on the one hand, are only as good as the content you put into them. If you speak a coherent sentence, it'll make sense. If you blabble on and just make up words, which is very easy to do, a lot of people do it a lot of the time, right? then it won't mean anything. So words are nothing really. They're just vehicles for the content that you put into them, correct? Yet we know that communication is the most powerful tool of the human being. Any intellectual concept, any emotion, any feeling, when it's communicated, goes to a whole new level. When you have a feeling and you start talking about it, the emotion grows, negative or positive. You know, people who are angry, we've said this before, and they start talking about the anger, they become more angry as they're talking. If people feel love and they start talking about the love, they have more love as they start talking. That's why one of the most practical and most effective strategies for anger management is just to keep quiet for a while, because the emotion will calm down, hopefully. Doesn't always, but it could. Right? Because that's what leadership is. That's what's the most powerful tool, this Malchut. So Malchut is the concept of taking everything we've talked about till now and then having the ability to actually communicate it to other people. And also use communication. To talk, to communicate, to tell people what you want to do, tell people how you feel, tell people what you're thinking. And use those words and use the implementation to actually carry out whatever it is that we feel or think, so that we can actually build and nurture on a practical level our emotions. But we've got to work with emotions before. We've got to have healthy emotions first. So when we have the right way of thinking, We take the pause, we process it, we are mindful of how we're feeling, where it's coming from. We try to blend the chesed and gevura. We stay with it even when there's setbacks. We have the netzach, we balance it with hard, we're ready to connect. Then we've got to actually connect. And that's where malchut comes in. That's what malchut puts it all together. In Kabbalistic works, malchut is often symbolized by the moon, which doesn't have its own light. It receives the light from the sun and transmits it further. That's why also Shabbat is called Malchut. Because Shabbat there was no creation, yet it took the creation to a whole new level. So that's why the Talmud says that the more we prepare for Shabbat, the more meaningful Shabbat is. Why? Because that's what God did. God created the world in 6 days. And then Shabbat just took what was already created. Right? We have this contradiction. If you look at the Kiddush, you'll see that we make every Friday night. It says, Vayechal Elokim Hayom Hashvi'i, God finished on the creating on the seventh day. We always know that that's not what happened. The whole idea of Shabbat is that he created for 6 days, he rested on the seventh day, right? So what does that mean? It means like this, and very briefly. God didn't rest, first of all. He doesn't feel that hard work. Doesn't feel the effort that much that he needs to work, right? And that he needs to rest, I mean. Rest rest doesn't mean rest. Rest means tranquility, harmony, serenity, peacefulness, elevation. And the Talmud tells us that when God created the world after 6 days, the world was finished. The world was complete, but it was missing something. It was lacking something. What was it lacking? Maha ya'alam chaser. What was it missing? Menucha. Peacefulness. Restfulness. So Shabbat came. Menucha came. That's why it says in the Kiddush, we keep Shabbat because God created the world in 6 days and rest on the seventh. But that resting completed the world. So what he did with Shabbat was that he finished. Vayechal Elokim means he finished, but also means he perfected, he elevated. So God elevated the world on Shabbat. The same world that was created in 6 days. That's why Shabbat is called Malchut. In fact, he created the world every day. Sunday is Chesed, Monday is Gvura, Tuesday is Tiferet. That's why Tuesday is considered a good day for many reasons. One of them is because it's Tiferet, it's a combination, it's a beauty, right? So each one of the 6 days is the six primary emotions. And then Shabbat is Malchus, because Shabbat doesn't have its own emotion, but it takes all the six and brings it to a greater level. That's why Shabbat is Malchut. Same idea in relationships. We build up the whole structure. We think and then we build up the whole feeling. We're ready to connect. Then we're going to make it happen. So Malchut is implementing it and communicating it and make sure it all comes together and nurtures and strengthens our relationships. I want to end off, because we talked about this last week, and it's, again, very much related to the whole emotional approach to things, with a thought that I just heard a couple of days ago from Rabbi Yossi Jacobson. Someone sent me a recording of, he spoke somewhere, and he quoted a fascinating story from the Jerusalem Talmud. A bizarre story, actually, but it has such an... on the surface, a bizarre story, but it has such an amazing lesson. Because we talked about the freshness of the moment. We talk about that one of the difficulties when we evolve in something emotionally is that mindful concept of being present in the now and not carrying over the baggage from the past and the future, but being able to be present in the now. So let me tell you this most amazing story about the power of now. The story is with two great Talmudic sages, Rabbi Yochanan and his brother-in-law, Reish Lakish. We actually told the story about one of them once before, but it's a different story. So Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, says the Jerusalem Talmud, traveled to Tiberias to immerse in the springs of Tiberias. You know, Tiberias has the famous hot springs of Tiberias, Chamei Tveria they're called in the Talmud. So they went to Tiberias. Now you should know with stories in the Talmud, often there's obviously details that we have to imagine, but we don't know. Because we just get told the story, we don't always get told the background or what happened before or after. But knowing the personalities of who we're talking about, some of it we're able to fill in, but it's amazing. You have to understand who these two people were. Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish were two of the greatest sages of the Talmud. They both lived in Israel. They were ultimate halachic authorities. There's sections of the Talmud very often that quote them. Some of the greatest. So they traveled to the, for whatever reason, maybe it was health reasons, whatever the reason was, they traveled to Tiberias to immerse in the hot springs of Tiberias. At the entrance to where they were going, there was a beggar who looked like and said that he hadn't eaten in a long time, and he asked them for money. Not the same story we've been talking about till now, but this is the thing. So for whatever reason, and this we don't know why, because on the surface it's a little strange, but we don't know why, Yochanan Rish Lakish said to him, "No problem, just wait here. We're just going in to immerse in the springs of Tveria. On the way out, we will take care of you." On the way out, they see this guy, and it was too late. He died. Right? Telling the story the way it is. Now imagine, stop for a second, and imagine what would have happened to us if that would happen. Right? Imagine the guilt. Imagine we'd be devastated. Imagine that we would not know what to do with ourselves. We were planning to help this guy. He was obviously hungry. We probably misdiagnosed how hungry he really was. We thought he could wait 5 minutes, for whatever reason. And it didn't work. Imagine how we would just be crazy. Now I assume, this is not part of the story, I assume that Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, we know they felt bad about it, because we'll soon see what they said, but I would assume that at a later stage, they did what we call a real teshuva. Because we find in the Talmud with these great sages stories of when they felt they did something wrong, the intensity of their repentance to the point of fasting and crying to God and doing all sorts of things to correct what they had done was very intense with these people. Much more than it is with us. We have a one year Yom Kippur, we have a period, we try our best, but with these people it was very intense. I'm sure that happened with them. But it didn't happen then. Listen to what they said. So one of them, I've forgotten which one of them turns to his brother-in-law and says the following. He says, "You know, we didn't merit to help this person when he's alive. But at least let us help him now." What they realized was, this was a person who was obviously homeless and he was lonely. And he needed to be taken care of now. There's another process after life. He needed to be buried. He needed a Jewish burial. He needed all the spiritual things that go with taking care of a person after they're alive. So that's what they said. They said, "We didn't merit to help this person when he was alive. Let us help him now." And they sprung into action. They organized a grave. They dug a grave. They took him. They were going to use him. They were going to put him through the whole ritual process of what is necessary after a person passes away. And they took him on themselves and they sprung into action. They were going to do all these things that you need to do to help someone after they pass away. And then there's a very interesting twist to the story. As they were undressing him to take off his clothes, to replace and to put him through the purity and to place shrouds, they found on his chest a sack full of gold coins. The guy actually wasn't homeless. He was not well, obviously. He was mentally not well. And he was someone who had a lot of wealth, but either couldn't spend it. It didn't mean that they shouldn't offend him. I'm just saying that the story changed. It wasn't exactly what they'd imagined when they came in. So the story, again, there's a lot of the story that we don't know. I am certain that when they finished that and they went home, they probably did a lot of stuff on their own to work it through. But here we learn an unbelievable thing. It's a very extreme story. But it's a story that happens to us all the time. Because what happens to us all the time is something happens to us and we realize that we've done something wrong. Or we feel bad about something that we've done. Now, we need to work through the things that we make. We need to work through the mistakes we make. But like the book of Tanya says, we need to do that in a guided way. We need to designate times to work through things that we've done wrong. And even if it means that for a period of time we need to have a certain feelings of guilt, healthy guilt, which is in order to facilitate further growth, that's possible, that's good, but that needs to be guided and needs to be done in specific times. And there are times that are reserved for that. Before a person goes to sleep, on Rosh Chodesh, the month of Elul, which is coming up, in Yom Kippur, there are times that are reserved in Jewish literature where we have to intensely do an audit and really focus and go through the things and learn from our mistakes. And even if it means incorporating a certain amount of healthy guilt, it has its place as well. But what we do often is not that. We feel bad about something and we start to feel really guilty, like the good old real Jewish guilt. And we carry the guilt with us and we start to wallow in the guilt. And all it does is, it doesn't fix the problem. It just paralyzes us. And what it does is, it makes us not be able to do the next thing right, and the third thing right, and the fourth thing right. So it messes up our day, our week, our month, often. Why? Because we're not able to let go of those emotions, because we just carry that moment, however intense or big or small it is, we carry that moment through with us for the rest of the day, for the rest of the week, or for the rest of the month. Whether it's someone, something said to us, or something we did, or something we said, or someone else said, we don't let go. What Rabbi Yochanan and Rish Lakish, I am absolutely 1000% certain that they understood the gravity of not helping that person on the way in because of the who they were. And I was also certain that when they got home, they would deal with it. But they were also able to say, it's not the time now. Right now, there's a call of the hour. The call of the hour is to help this person in a different way. Let's jump in and let's not be paralyzed by the stuff that happened 5 minutes ago or a half an hour ago. What happened 5 minutes ago needs to be dealt with. We'll deal with it when it needs to be dealt with. And I'm sure they dealt with it properly. But right now, we need to be in the now. We need to be in the moment. So just, I mean, it's obviously at a very intense level, and I don't think regular people probably do this on that level, but the lesson is very simple. The lesson is that's how mindfulness works, particularly with our emotions, that we have to, as much as we can, try and deal with each moment of what's needed. That's that Tiferet concept. Look at the truth. What is necessary now? Is it my guilt that's necessary now? Or is it the mission that I need to implement that's necessary now? Is it the conversation I have to have now? What's the malchut? How am I going to make it work now? And to make it work now, fully, to its fullest potential, normally means that we have to let the emotions of the 5 minutes ago let go of it. And if we do need to learn from it or deal with it, we do it at its right time and its appropriate time. So that's just today. I wanted to sort of finish this off because we went through the ten powers. So I thought we'd finish it off with those three last ones and the final one of malchut. So just once again, a reminder that next week Rabbi Wolf will give the class, Rabbi Label Wolf from Melbourne, that is. And have a wonderful, wonderful week, and looking forward to seeing you on Tuesday night, if not sooner.